Blog Talk Radio.
Like the folks you meet on, like to plant my feet on the Brooklyn Bridge. What a lovely view from heaven looks at you from the Brooklyn Bridge. I love to listen to the wind through her strings, the song that she sings for the town. I love to look up at the clouds in her hair. She's learned to wear like a crown. If you've been a rover, journey's end lies over the Brooklyn Bridge. Don't let no one tell you I've been trying to sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. Cause they look at her and wish they had the good old Brooklyn Bridge.
Welcome to House New York with Brooklyn real estate attorney Robert Howe. Tonight we're looking at the rental real estate relationship between landlords and tenants. We're joined by Benjamin Meskin. Stay tuned for Bob.
Like the folks you meet on, like to plant my feet on the Brooklyn Bridge. What a lovely view from heaven looks at you from the Brooklyn Bridge.
Hey, it's Howe's New York with Brooklyn real estate attorney Robert Howe. And on tonight's episode, we are going to be looking at the rental relationship between landlords and tenants. And as always, here is our host, Robert Howe.
Well, welcome everyone to Howe's New York. I'm your host again, Robert Howe, and we're talking about a multitude of topics, including real estate, community, politics, and any hot topics of the day. We're broadcasting from an undisclosed location in Brooklyn, New York, to a potential audience stretching from Longyearbyen, Norway, to Ushuaia, Tierra del Fuego, thanks to the power of Blog Talk Radio. I'm here with my executive producer, Jason Versace of Rising Tide Marketing. And tonight we have as a guest Ben Meskin. Ben Meskin is an attorney in Brooklyn, New York, Brooklyn, of course, being the hottest borough in the city. And Ben, among other areas of law that he practices, practices landlord-tenant court. And we're going to discuss with him the dynamics of landlords and tenants, a question that many people, or a topic that many people have questions about, and we're going to get some real answers tonight. So welcome, Ben, to our show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Ben, remind us, what part of Brooklyn are you in, and your office address and phone
My
number?
My office address is 117 11th Street, Suite 209, Brooklyn 11215, and my office number is 718-246-1725. I guess I'm in what they now call Gowanus, though when I first got here some time ago, they were still calling it Lower Park Slope, or just Park Slope.
Yes, I actually asked you that question in hopes that you would give us that answer, how over the years of our living in Bay Ridge, you and I, or Brooklyn, I should say, you and I are longtime Brooklynites, how things have changed and how names of communities have changed and become, much more hipper.
Actually, you know, the only official authority for names is the New York City Department of City Planning. And they give neighborhood designations usually so they can keep track of, and they give it to community boards. And so community boards will say, this is what happened in the Gowanus part of the district, and here's what happened in the officially Park Slope part of the district. But, you know, people call things what they want. this area here was always been technically Gowanus since I've been around here over 25 years, but only in the past 10 years or so did people begin to say, oh, I'm in Gowanus. I guess they felt there was a new identity in some way, and people can call a neighbor whatever they want. No laws against it.
Yes, yes, yes. So you practice, among other things, landlord-tenant law, and we thought, who better to talk about the topics and dynamics between landlord-tenants, especially when they disagree. But maybe a good jumping-off point is if you would discuss briefly the types of rentals that there are out there and any regulations attached, to those rentals.
Well, there's something that we call rent-regulated apartments, and I'm not going to address all of them, but the main things you have is you used to have something called rent control, which is there's not very much of that left. And that can be in any building of three or more. And if you were there as of sometime in 1972, or if you inherited from, someone who you had a right to succeed from, there's no lease. You're a tenant by law. And as long as there's no serious violations, what we call C violations, violations have to be fixed in 24 hours, every year you can increase the rent by 7%. Now, in the very small buildings, the landlords didn't want to do that. It was so much paperwork. If you're getting $50 a month rent, and then you do all this paperwork and it goes up 7%, it's almost nothing. But people who kept doing it, like in the large buildings that still had rent-controlled tenants, over time, if you're 7% every year, rent-controlled tenants where that was done are paying reasonable rents. Maybe not market rents, but, respectable rents. But there's not much rent control left. You then have something called rent stabilization, and that's buildings that where it's six or more, and the building was built, sometime up to through 1974. So a building built in 1976 is not rent control, is not rent stabilized. Now, the exception is if you got a government subsidy of some type to build the building, and then it's rent stabilized. But so you have the six or more, you're rent stabilized. And rent stabilized, the landlord has to offer the tenant a lease. First lease, you have the tenant, landlord wants to take the tenant, and it's 1 or 2 years. And the amount of rent is set by the state agency, as is for rent control, the New York State agency called the Division of Housing and Community Renewal. And there's a set amount to start, as over time, over the history. And there's a set amount, that's sent as a board in New York called the New York City Rent Guidelines Board, and they say how much it can go up. So you have to offer a tenant a first lease of 1 or 2 years and renewal leases of 1 to 2 years. And that's the only way the rent gets raised in rent-stabilized apartments, by the landlord offering a lease. If the landlord doesn't want to give a new lease, the rent doesn't go up. Those people are protected. Basically, as long as they behave themselves and pay the rent, they can be there forever or for a very long time. And their immediate family has succession rights. The first succession, suppose it's a mother, her son's living with her for 20 years, the mother moves away, the son gets the son succeeds to the apartment with the same rights, same rent as the mother. The son lives there another 20 years, moves out, his son, who's now 25, takes it over. Well, that's a second succession, and there they have to give you a lease, but it goes like a vacancy, but they have to offer a new vacancy, all the increases that would happen when there's a vacancy, and it goes to, it has to be offered to that second successor, but not at the old rent. It would ever be a vacancy increase. That's it. Now, there's lots of housing in New York which is not rent regulated. Larger buildings built after 1974, and lots of small buildings, one families, two families, three families, four families, five families. In those buildings, landlords don't have to give a lease, and they don't have to renew a lease. People often just pay month to month. The difference when you're a landlord of a small building, and also tenants should keep this in mind, that when you're a landlord of a small building, if you give a lease to a tenant, that means, as long as the tenant behaves him or herself and pays their rent, they're there for the duration of the lease. But they don't have to give a renewal, they don't have to give a new lease, and they don't have to keep the tenant there after the lease is over. So there's also something for tenants to keep in mind. They are protected by a lease in the small buildings, but the landlord doesn't have to give them a new lease and doesn't have to keep them there either afterwards. So a tenant who might be in a building where they feel the landlord is doing something which isn't right, they can complain, they may even get some results, but ultimately the landlord doesn't have to keep them there. Nothing happens overnight, but ultimately the landlord can evict them.
And Ben, is there a theory for a small landlord where there are no controls involved? give a lease or not give a lease? What is your opinion?
I would say don't give a lease, because if you have a lease, and suppose the tenant is doing something, you know, wrong, creating a nuisance, creating a problem, well, you have to go to court and prove it. You have to go to court and prove it. And proving things, knowing something happened and proving something happened, is not always the same thing. There's many things we know are true, but can we actually prove it? That's another question. You might have two tenants in a, you know, three-family building, and one tenant's making a great deal of noise and creating problems in the building, and the other tenants are complaining, but they won't go to court and testify. That often happens. Okay? But if you don't give them a lease and they just pay month to month, and you wish them to leave, you don't need to give a reason. You need to serve a notice that ends their tenancy, and then after, you know, under law, ends their tenancy as of such and such a date, and after that, you begin a case in the housing court to evict them. And it won't happen overnight again, but they will be out within, you know, a period of months. So the leases in those small non-rent regulated buildings protects the tenant more than the landlord. If I was a landlord of a small building, the only person I'd give a lease to might be someone who said, gee, I just got out of my professional school, I'm making a lot of money, I work, you know, 12-hour days, I'm never home, and on weekends I go and see my parents. But I want a 2-year lease, and I'll pay you, you know, 1.5 times what you're asking, but I want a lease. That's the person you give a lease to, because that's a tenant you want very much.
Correct.
Otherwise, from the landlord's point of view, it's better not to give a lease in the small buildings.
So tell us, what are some of the remedies landlords have? I guess you could break it up between when tenants don't pay or when tenants are misbehaving for some reason.
Okay.
What are some of the landlord's remedies?
Well, we call this, the first one is called a non-payment. And there so the tenant's not paying the rent, and, you know, you can do that if they have a lease or not have a lease. And you have to send a rent demand notice. Most landlord-tenant cases start by serving a notice first before you go to court. You serve a rent demand notice saying you have to pay, you know, the default under law is 3 days, and many leases say 5 days. Many of us attorneys do 5 days anyhow, because by the time it gets served, and you get it back, you know, the time the paper goes out to be served, which is, you know, delivered as, you know, as called for under the law, you know, the time will have passed anyhow. So if they haven't then paid with 5 days after the notice is given to them, the rent demand notice, you then begin a non-payment proceeding. And if the tenant comes at any point and pays the rent, not just the rent which is demanded, but suppose, you know, you serve them a notice, let's say, in the 20th of the month, and by the time you get to landlord-tenant court, it's a new month, but you have to base the case on what's demanded in the notice. So now, you know, you've based your case on what was owed in, let's say, March, and now you're in court in April. You know, the tenant can't just end the case by paying what's owed in March. Let's put it like this. If the tenant pays you what's owed in March and you take it, and because your court papers, your demand, and your court papers say, I'm owed rent through March, and you give the landlord takes it, the case is over, even though they still owe in April. So in that case, the landlord should say, I tell people, if they pay you everything you're owed as of the day they pay it to you, the case is over. If they offer you less, you have a right to refuse it. Now, in a non-payment case, tenants can bring up the defense of conditions in the apartment that require repair. But the tenant has to have given the landlord clear notice before, and that's usually meant sending something by certified mail, return receipt requested. Though in these days, if you can show you sent an email or a text and prove it, many judges will take that also. But that does not usually end up in very low, and, you know, if you prove it, right, if you can prove you gave the landlord notice and you put that as a defense and you prove it, you know, you might, if you have a trial, and most things don't go to trial, you might get a small amount off the rent. It's usually not a great deal off the rent. If you get that much off the rent, the apartment probably is not even safe to live in. You know, if you get like 30% off the rent or something, or even 25%, the apartment's probably barely worth living in or not safe to live in. Most non-payment cases settle one of two ways. Often you say, we'll pay out in such and such a time, and if the tenant says there are repairs, the landlord has to, you know, say, you sign an agreement, the landlord says, I'll fix these conditions. You say there are these conditions. I'll inspect and repair required by law. You give me access on these dates, and I'll complete by such and such a time. Now, if the tenant doesn't pay, the landlord has remedies. And if the landlord doesn't fix, the tenant has remedies, but they're separate. I say to a landlord, if the tenant doesn't pay, you still have to fix. And I say to the tenant, if the landlord doesn't fix, you still have to pay. Sometimes if it's a longer payout, the landlord will get a judgment and a warrant. And if the tenant doesn't pay, they evict. Sometimes if it's a short payout, the tenant landlord may have to come back to court to do it. I will say this about repairs. Many landlords flip out about repairs. My point of view is it's your building. If there's a problem, you should fix it, because today it may be a $300 problem, and if you don't fix it, in a year or so it'll be a $5,000 problem. You know, so that's my philosophy on that. The other main type of case is a holdover case. That's about possession. It's not about the payment of rent. It's that I want the apartment back. And there's two kinds. It could be if there's a lease, you say, you know, or if they're rent regulated, you say they've done something wrong. Suppose there's a lease that says you can't have a washing machine, and there's a washing machine. So you bring them to court to get them to remove the washing machine. The judge may give them time to remove it, you know, even if you actually have a trial. Most of these things, again, settle. The tenant says they'll remove it. If it's not removed, the landlord can do, you know, can either bring the case back or already has a warrant. But the judge, even if you have a trial, the judge will usually give a tenant time to remove it. It could be a nuisance, noise, smoking, pets, if it's not on the lease, though if the lease says no pets. But if a landlord, if someone has a pet and the landlord knows about it for more than 60 days and doesn't do anything, under New York City law, the pet stays. So people should do things promptly when they learn about it, landlords. Those are you know, holdovers for cause when you have a lease or where you're in rent regulation. But if you're in a small building that's not rent regulated and you don't have a lease, you know, so let's take the situation where you don't have a lease. You send a notice. We call it a notice of termination. Let's say someone pays, it's a month-to-month tenant. It's an oral arrangement. Every day, every month, the first of the month, they pay the rent. Well, you send someone a notice that says at the end of the next rental period, call a 30-day notice, the end of the next rental period, your tenancy will end. So suppose you send out a notice in the middle of April and you say your tenancy will end on May 31st. And it says if you don't leave on that date, we will go to court to begin a case to evict you. We call this a holdover case. The idea is that a tenant has a right to be there. Same thing with the nuisance or the problem. So they have a right to be there. If you end the tenancy, then they're not a tenant anymore, and they don't have a right to be there. And then you bring a case. We say they've held over in the premises after the tenancy ended. We call it a holdover case. It's kind of an archaic turn of phrase. So if there's no lease, you just do the 30-day notice, and you don't. We call it a no-cause holdover. You don't have to prove that they did anything wrong. You have to prove I'm the owner. I serve the termination notice. I serve the court papers properly, and the tenant is not rent regulated. You know, and that's it. That's your basic holdover in a small building, not rent regulated, and there's no lease. If there is a lease and it's not rent regulated, when the lease ends, by operation of law, the tenant stops being a tenant. And then you can just bring a case without having to serve a notice. Now, there's always little exceptions to all of this, so it's always good to talk to a lawyer who knows what they're doing. But that's the basic way it works. There are many leases that say that you get attorney's fees, and many landlords ask for them. The law in New York, and it's a case law rule, but it's held up by all the courts, is you only get those fees after a trial. So, and even if you get the fees, they're not part, in a residential context, they're never part of the rent. So if you had a trial with someone and said they owed $5,000 rent, let's say 5 months and $1,000 a month, and attorney's fees of whatever it is, the judgment for the rent, they could be evicted if they don't pay it. The judgment for the attorney's fees is just like a regular money judgment. They pay the judgment for the rent, they stay. The other judgment you have to collect, or maybe make an arrangement with the tenant of some kind.
So how do we counsel? I know I get a lot of people in, I get a landlord in who says, my tenant is 20 or 30 days late, I want to either sue them or cancel their lease.
If they have a written lease, and you've let them go to 20 or 25 days, so let's say it's now April 25th, right? I'd say you might as well wait to May 1st and send them a notice for both months' rent. You know, and the other, if they come to you on April 10th, you might as well send something out on April 10th.
Right,
and
but
again,
as you point out, in some cases, when they pay, that's the end of the case.
If they pay everything that's owed as of the day they pay it. So suppose you send out a notice on April 10th, and then on May 2nd, and now you start a court case, and they walk in and give you April's rent. You can say no. I'm not taking it unless I get everything. Because otherwise, people would always do that, and they'd just always be a month late. So you have a right to refuse the rent if you start, you know, unless it's everything that you're owed as of that day. You know, Bob, I hate to do this, but I'm on the phone in my office, and someone is calling me. Let me get rid of them, okay? Can you hold on? This is you know, business.
We'll hold on. Yes, absolutely. Well, we are talking with Ben Meskin about landlord-tenant. That's usually a very popular topic, among many clients who visit their real estate attorneys. Landlords are saying things like, "I want to raise
I'm back.
The rent."
Here we go.
Okay, good, Ben. I was just filling in while you were just saying it's a popular topic with a client's real estate attorney when, you know, landlords are asking, how do I get people out? How do I collect the rent? And seller and tenants are saying or asking their real estate attorney, well, you know, the landlord's not providing me services. And
well, that's a defense to a non-payment case. It's not a defense to a holdover case.
Holdover seems to be just, I want the apartment back.
That's right. It's about possession.
Yes. And how
sometimes,
about landlords who seek your advice and say, I want to get out, that maybe this where controls exist, rent control or rent stabilization. I want such and such apartment for my daughter or son.
You have a right. It's called a personal use holdover. You know, you have to show the building has to be owned by an individual person. It can't be a corporation or an LLC because, you know, they don't have immediate family. It has to be a member of the immediate family of the owner, the individual landlord. And, you know, and if you do that case and they move in there, they have to stay there for 3 years. Can't be fake. Move them in. They leave in 3 months. You fix the apartment, get to raise the rent, oodles, and then rent to somebody else. You can't do that. For that matter, if you say, oh, I want this apartment, and in the meantime, another apartment exactly the same floor opens up and you rent to somebody else, then it's obviously not real either. It has to be real. It can be fought. You know, if it has to seem real, it can't be, oh, my son is living in a penthouse apartment, you know, on Central Park South on the 27th floor with this great view of Central Park, and they want to live in a, you know, the second floor apartment on a nice building, but a side street in Bay Ridge, you know, where that sort of usually doesn't make sense. It might even more say, oh, they want to live on a second floor apartment in Brownsville. It's like, why, you know? So it has to make sense, but you can do it. It doesn't happen overnight. After a holdover trial, a judge, for any reason, a judge can give a tenant up to 6 months to stay, provide they pay everything they owe going back and pay everything going forward. So none of this will happen overnight if you're doing it. That's only in rent regulated. If it's not rent regulated, there is no such, you know, way to bring a case for personal use. And you just wait till the lease expires, or you just serve a 30-day notice, you know.
So what are people doing? You know, we hear every now and then news reports of a senior citizen living in off Central Park West or South or East,
mm-hmm.
and they're paying the $50 a month that you've talked about earlier in the show. Is that person there forever?
Well, they are there. I mean, if an immediate family member moves in with them and is there, and that immediate family member had become, and when the time the tenant dies, the immediate family member has been there, you know, 2 years and it's their primary residence, then they have succession rights. Now, if an apartment and in that large building is still so low, that is a great deal with a problem of management, why weren't they, you know, doing what they had to do to get the rents up, okay? I will say that, you know, you will occasionally find something like that where someone's living in this very desirable apartment, which would be very expensive if it was market rate or a condo or a co-op, and they're still there and they're rent controlled and it's so unfair. It's like, well, nothing's perfect. You know, the purpose of rent regulation was to make sure that there were apartments that were available to working people, middle-class people. Will there be some, will you occasionally find an instance where it hasn't really worked out that way, or this person could have more money? It will happen sometimes. But that's the exception, not the rule. Most people who live in rent-regulated apartments are you know, middle-class working people. And one way that you can, by the way, get someone out of any kind of rent-regulated apartment if you want, you decide what it's worth to you. You can offer people money to go. You say, well, you shouldn't have to. I say, well, you know, the law is the law. You know, if someone was willing to take is willing to take a buyout, that happens also. And the amount of the buyout usually depends on how long they've been there, how old they are, how much they were paying, what neighborhood it's in. A buyout, for instance, in, I'm trying to think of a neighborhood. Well, let's say a buyout in Kensington is, you know, in Brooklyn, which is on the other side from Park Slope, the other side of Prospect Park, would not be as much as a buyout, let's say, in Brooklyn Heights or Carroll Gardens, for the sake of argument. But you can do that. If you're serious and you want to do it, you can do it. Real estate is usually good for people who have a long-term point of view. After you buy them out, fix up the apartment, and raise the rent, you'll make your money back over a period of years.
Now, Ben, are there other protections that tenants have, either gender, orientation, age, medical condition? Are there any protections among
those
areas?
Well, there's protections against discrimination, but, you know, you senior citizens can be evicted. It may take longer, but it can be done. People who are ill can be evicted. May take longer, but it can be done. Sometimes if a person, you know, is a person, you know, a person in need or a person who has special needs, sometimes the judge will appoint what's called a guardian ad litem, which is someone who assists them in court. Sometimes they'll get a city agency involved to become like a guardian that has powers over the person. And that guardian may eventually move the person out of there. But, you know, it takes longer, and it's very frustrating for a landlord. But maybe, you know, when you think about it, if someone's 90 years old, maybe it should take a little longer to evict them. It's not a thing to be done lightly, you know. But senior citizens can be evicted.
And why don't we end on this note, Ben? How long might these actions take? What is can you give us an idea of how long they would take?
Part of it has to do with, you know, the volume in the court. I mean, let's take an example. A holdover case in a small building where there's no lease, a no-cause holdover. So you get to court, and the first time, your first court appearance, you don't have a trial. You have what's called a conference. You talk about it. The landlord, if you don't settle, if you don't come to say, oh, you might say something like, listen, by the time we have a trial and I get my warrant and I evict you, it may take me another 2 months to actually have the trial. It might take another month to get the court to issue the warrant, and then 3 weeks or so for the landlord to evict. So that's, you know, 3.5 months, right? So you might say, and the only thing that will happen at 3.5 months is the landlord's lawyer will keep getting paid. The tenant's not going to pay the landlord if they're going to be evicted, right? And the landlord may or may not be able to go after the tenant later. Sometimes it's better to just say, fine. If you leave, you know, you give the landlord, the tenant would agree to the landlord, you have a judgment of possession, which lets you get a warrant of eviction, and you can order the warrant right away, but you can't use it until such and such a date. And if the tenant leaves by such and such a date, they don't owe anything to the landlord for rent. Usually in those circumstances, the tenant gives up their claim to get back their security deposit. So it might take 3.5 months or so. Now, if you had that trial, the judge might say, well, after the trial, I give you another 4 months if you pay everything. The landlord has to decide, what, do they want them out more quickly, or do they want to get all the rent? But, you know, it depends on the time the tenant gets. Depends, again, how long they've been in the apartment, how much money they make, how many children they have, how old they are. Someone who's been in an apartment for 25 years might have two teenagers, and, you know, let's say it's two parents, and one is unemployed and the other is underemployed, and the rent isn't too high, a judge will probably give those people 6 months because it'll take them 6 months to find somewhere. On the other hand, let's say you have two people living there together and they both make, you know, $90,000 a year and they've been there 3 years, the judge will probably give them more like 3 or 4 months to go. But it doesn't take forever. It can be done if you're willing to do it. And it's a lot quicker than if someone's hit by a car where it might take them 2 or 3 years to have a trial. and keep it all in perspective, you know.
Well, talking about perspective, thank you, Ben, for putting this in perspective. And
you're very welcome.
It sounds like a not overly complicated area of law, but
Well, I gave you the basics. I didn't bring up all the exceptions.
There are
exceptions. I gave you what happens most of the time. There are exceptions. There's always an exception.
Yes, and we appreciate you putting it in easily understandable terms and what generally happens. Of course, we all know once you get into court, all hell could break loose.
Yes.
Hopefully, that would not be the case. But we do appreciate you coming on. Our time is over, and we want to thank you and encourage our listeners, if you have any further real estate landlord-tenant questions, Ben Meskin is the man in Brooklyn to go after. So thank you, Ben, for coming on our show.
And thank you for the opportunity. Take care, Bob.
Well, this you're welcome. Good night. And this concludes tonight's radio program. Thanks to Blog Talk Radio for hosting our show, and thanks to our guest, Ben Meskin, attorney in Brooklyn, New York, who, among other areas of law, practices landlord-tenant, for his sharing his insights with us. This is How's New York signing off. God bless Brooklyn and all of its people. Wishing you a good night and a good morning, a good afternoon. I'm your host, Robert Howe.
Like the folks you meet on, like to plant my feet on the Brooklyn Bridge. What a lovely view from heaven looks at you from the Brooklyn Bridge.